mine for you to look at.
Well, I might need to look at some names there in the back.
Oh, okay.
Got plenty of them.
Yes. I've got a few. The background, the build-up about what happened.
That's fine. Why don't we just get into that and then talk about maybe how the positions were manned and all that?
Well, of course, for many months prior to the Friday attack on June the 20th, my battalion, the 1st Battalion, 26th Marines, was the only battalion at Quezon. It was also the headquarters of the 26th Marine Regiment, which was originally commanded by Colonel Padley, and then he was replaced by Colonel Dave Wild. Since we were the only infantry battalion up there, we were pretty spread out. Basically, I had a company on 881, one company on 861. I had a company down at a bridge site on Route 9, protecting one of the bridges over a stream, because most of our resupply during the summer came by convoy, truck convoy. Initially, there was a platoon of scout snipers, regimental scout snipers, on Hill 950, which was, while not the tallest hill, it was probably the best observation post in and around Quezon. It was my practice to rotate each company from hill to hill, depending on the personalities of the company commander involved, because some companies would be far more productive than others in improving their positions. For example, I might keep B Company on a hill longer than C Company, because possibly the company commander of B Company could get a lot more out of his troops as far as putting in more wire, digging more trenches, improving the overhead. It seemed that, as a matter of fact, that B Company was the most productive company. So I tended to keep them on 881 quite a long time during the summer. And periodically, when I felt that they had been away from the so-called bright lights of the combat base, I would bring them down to Quezon Combat Base and replace them with another company, and then rotate the rifle company down at the bridge site, and that way try to break up the monotony, because there was very little enemy contact at that time. There had been a rocket attack in late June of 67. I arrived there on June the 30th of 67, but really for the next 6 months, there was very little contact. So my primary problem was keeping the troops from getting bored while maintaining their high peak of attentiveness to their duties. Later on, the monsoons hit in September. We pulled the company off the bridge down on Route 9 because the road was impassable. The bridges were all washed out. And for the next several weeks, all of our resupply came by helicopter. So at that time, that gave me a little more flexibility. I had two companies in the combat base, and by using H&S Company and filling in the lines, I could almost get two full rifle companies to go out on a sweep for an offensive operation. And then the build-up Quezon combat base started. Another battalion from the 26th Marine was brought in. At that time, we still had a company on 881, a company on 861. I thought we had done a fine job of improving the positions, particularly on 881. They were fairly well dug in. Everyone had overhead cover, although because of the monsoon rains, most of the bunkers were not deep in the ground. They tended to be on the subsurface. The soil on 861, of course, 861 was closer to the combat base than 881. 861 soil did not lend itself to a lot of digging in. In fact, the trench line had been washed away so often during the monsoon that we finally were able to get some 55-gallon drums, and we placed them all around the hill, and to form this sort of a gutter, that you would visualize a gutter around the house, and the 55-gallon drums were the spouts by which the water escape the trenches, and that helped preserve the trenches on 861. The previous battles, the hill battles of 881, 861, that had occurred months before, it sounds unbelievable, but had left so much shrapnel in the trees that when the engineers would use their chainsaws to try to bring the trees down, the chainsaws would hit the shrapnel and they were really rendered useless. So we ended up having to go out farther away from the hills and cut down trees and bring them in. We did this fairly successfully at the combat base to improve our positions, but up on the hills, it was very difficult because of the terrain. If you got a pretty good sized log, it might take you 3 or 4 days to get it back. So as a result, we had to sort of do the Marine Corps jury rig method of building up those positions. So I finally got my battalion together in December of 67. And in December of 67, I was successful in mounting a battalion-sized operation out to the north and northeast of the combat base. We had some indications that the enemy had been moving troops down. We also knew that the Ho Chi Minh Trail was just a short distance over, but we had never been able to go over and interdict the Ho Chi Minh Trail, because really at that point it was the Ho Chi Minh Trail was probably still over in Laos, and we were not permitted, nor did we have the capability of crossing the river going into Laos. So as we neared the end of the calendar year 1967, my battalion was at the combat base. We had gone out, and on one of our battalion operations, we sort of flushed out a party of about 20 to 25 North Vietnamese. This excited everyone. To tell you how ridiculously excited we all got, we killed one North Vietnamese, and we were able to pick up his rifle. It happened to be a brand new model that had never been seen. It was a different type metal, obviously had not been manufactured in Hanoi, and we radioed this information into Colonel Lowndes, and he became very interested in this. So we flew the remains of this young NVA in with his weapon back to the regiment, where he was closely scrutinized by intelligence experts. We're also able to pick up some very valuable intelligence information at this time. Probably the most valuable was a map that one of the people on what I assumed to be was a scouting party or an advance party for the main body to follow later, was a map that had some diagrams of projected roads that the North Vietnamese were going to build in toward Khe Sanh. So while I'm sure that higher echelons such as General Westmoreland and possibly General Cushman knew at that time in December that the North Vietnamese were mounting a massive attack on Khe Sanh, this was really the first hard factual information that those of us at Khe Sanh had. This is not to say that we were not brought abreast on everything else, because we were. But we were really, really sort of, in the Marine Corps tradition, pretty gung-ho about what we found. We brought the battalion back in, and we had one Marine wounded in this little skirmish and had killed only one NVA. But that was the first real sign of the enemy that my battalion had seen for several months. So we sort of had the impression that better things were ahead for us down the road, better things being more action. We came back in. At that time, I had most all of my company was charged with the security of the combat base. The other battalion, the 26 Marines, had taken our place on Hill 881 and 861. Early in the summer, as I mentioned, my platoon, Colonel Lowndes, had become very unhappy with his scout sniper's performance up on Hill 950. It seemed that hill required a certain type of leadership because they were so isolated. So I set up a platoon, and we maintained a platoon up on 950 from then on throughout the so-called CGK zone. So that was the way the battalion stood, in and around. We had all the perimeter. And later on, we were later to have some of that perimeter taken away from us when we were able to get an additional two infantry battalions of caissons for a total of four. We had the full 26 Marines plus Jack Mitchell's 1st Battalion 9th Marines. But to regress a little bit, by mid-January, I think all of us in command situations knew that there was going to be a major enemy effort to attack Quezon. We had taken extra precautions. While we had not been able to do a lot of digging in because of the monsoon and the trench lines would wash away and our little jury-rigged logs would not hold up, we had continued to improve the positions. I had made extra efforts to improve my battalion aid station because I really had nothing undercover when I first got there. With the help of an engineer platoon, we had secured rather huge logs and had sort of hardened the battalion aid station to the degree that probably 20 to 30 cots had been placed in there. And I had a very aggressive battalion surgeon, Navy Lieutenant Harv DeMag. When I say aggressive, although he was a tremendous surgeon, trained to be a surgeon, I had to order him specifically not to go out on patrols with squads and not to go out on listening posts with fire teams because, as I explained to Harv, I'd have a difficult time explaining how a man of his background and training had been killed out on an ambush with a squad. So Harv then turned his attention to the supervision of building this battalion aid station. And it was finished in plenty of time to be used. And in fact, when the influx of TV and other media came in, one of the Life magazines had a color picture of the interior of the battalion aid station. In later weeks, Colonel Lowndes became under quite a bit of verbal attack because the regimental aid station, which was probably 100 yards from my battalion aid station, was under canvas. In other words, a primal tent can't hold back a 130-millimeter artillery piece, but we continued to use my battalion aid station, but when someone was more seriously wounded, he had to go to the regimental aid station, and the whole world became aware that the Marines at Quezon did not have a hardened or even a halfway hardened aid station. But I felt that I had my battalion had one, and I don't know why it was not used. Probably because it was not close enough to the LZ. It was a little bit off the LZ. We had also hardened our command post. There was a caisson had originally been built, they tell me, by the French as an outpost. And later, the South Vietnamese had occupied it. And I was able to find the remnants of an old French bunker or an old South Vietnamese bunker that was very, very long. It had been filled in with some trash and debris over the years, but we cleaned that out. With the help of the engineers, we got additional large logs, and I converted that into a battalion command post. And I moved my everyone but my S1 moved in there. In fact, I slept in there as of January the 20th, so I could be close to all the communications gear. Then in about mid-January, there were increasing signs of the enemy coming into Vietnam. The recon company was starting to discover signs of enemy. These were not just scouting parties. These were hardcore line troops. Probably the most interesting thing that happened was during the day, on I think January 19th or January 20th, at about mid-afternoon, we had the engineers had a bulldozer that was improving the some of our fields of fire for us, and I had a fire team providing some security. And my S2 gave me a call and told me that a Chuhoy had just turned himself in. It turned out to be an officer, first lieutenant who commanded who claimed he commanded an anti-aircraft company. Got my driver, my Jeep, and my S2. We drove down to the end of the airstrip, and the fire team had, to their credit, had not blown this poor guy away. He came out with a white flag and had laid his weapon down beforehand, so they brought him in. I was very suspicious, but he was wearing his insignia of rank. He spoke no English. I had an interpreter with me, who was also a Chuhoy of many years standing, and I immediately gave him some battlefield interrogation, and he pointed to a hill called 1015, which had a contour coming down to the river, which was on the one side of the airstrip there, and he told us that his entire anti-aircraft company was in place on that hill, which had a very commanding view of the airstrip, and he proceeded to tell us that there was going to be one hell of a battle that was going to start very, very soon. I took him in my Jeep, we took him up to Colonel Lowndes' quarters. By odd coincidence, the G2 of the of 3rd MAF happened to be paying a visit to Colonel Lowndes. And so I interrupted their conversation and told them that we had really a fantastic prisoner, a Chuhoy. So they brought Colonel Lowndes and 3rd MAF brought in a top team of interrogators that really knew their job and kept him up there for one night and one day. And I understand that he told a lot of interesting information, and he ended up being, I guess, the toast of Saigon. Where the poor guy is now, I don't know. I've often thought about him. I hope he's back in the United States. But anyway, he provided some. He saved a tremendous number of lives because we believe what he told us. That same evening, a recon patrol from the reconnaissance company started radioing back that they were right off the trail, and that many, many enemy were passing right by them. I had one company sort of in reserve, and they were not in the lines of the combat base. They were in a sort of open area of the combat base, away from the ammunition dump. And I alerted them to the fact that they may have to go bail out the recon platoon, because frequently we would have to send a platoon or a company to help extract a recon patrol. And I felt that as soon as that we might have to start moving them out that night. So the company commander was at that time was Lieutenant Spencer. So he decided to saddle up his company and move them out of where they were bivouacked and move them into some trenches that had been previously dug with some cover. I think this saved the fact that they were alerted to the possibility of moving out. They had their gear with them, possibly saved some of their lives when the ammo dump later blew up. By this time in January, we were all wearing our flak vest, our helmets all the time. We had been wearing our gas mask at all times. Between 4 and 5 in the morning, this was either on June 20th or June 21st, I was fully clothed except for my boots, and I was in my my little the little bunker that I slept in when I wasn't over in the main command post, the first incoming mortars started raining down on us. And I put on my helmet and put on my boots and grabbed my gas mask and raced across the terrain there, and still with the mortars were starting to impact on the ammo dump. But I was able to make it into the command post. And I should pause and say, you know, and answer the unasked question, why was the battalion CP alongside the ammo dump? Which is an interesting question. Caisson was not, the base itself was not planned. In other words, no one came in when the base started and said, well, we'll put the ammo dump here and we'll put this here and this here and this here. It just so happened that the ammo dump happened to be there, I guess, from the beginning, probably from the old hill battles, and probably some of the ammo had been left around. And when I arrived to take over the battalion in late June of 67, I found that my command post was right flush next to the ammo dump. And my and one of my trench lines ran right, was in fact formed one side, one large side of the ammo dump. And this was not an ammo dump with M16 ammo. I mean, it had 155 artillery rounds, 105, Willie Peter, TNT, C3, you name it. If it's in the it's in the book, it was probably stored there. So obviously the North Vietnamese knew what they were after. They were after the ammo dump. And it didn't take them long to start something burning. By this time, we sort of thought that we were in for a ground attack. The recon patrol that had been pinned down by this time, and I don't think they had taken any casualties when they were up on the hill with all the NVA moving in. The NVA were actually moving in to attack one of the hill positions, we found out later. But the recon patrol came back to the combat base, and I think most of them were wounded by incoming mortar rounds. While they had escaped the enemy up on the hill, when they got down to the combat base, they took a lot of casualties. Meantime, I had more to worry about than the recon patrol, which was really not under my control anyway. The ammo dump was starting to burn. I had Captain Ken Pipes, who at that time was the company commander of B Company, had had to displace his CP at least twice because of when the ammo dump started burning, shells would be propelled through the air and would land in or near his CP. We did not have many casualties that morning. Initially, I think we had three or four killed. One, unfortunately, was Ken Pipes' radio operator. Ken displaced his CP and just did a hell of a job of maintaining the control over his company, which happened to be right in that trench line with these shells from our ammo dump coming down. About mid-morning, by this time the tear gas had started to go off, and most of us had brought our gas mask into the bunker with us, and of course all the troops had their, you know, they lived with all their things, so they had their gas mask with them. Initially we did not realize that it was our own tear gas. We sort of thought that the enemy might be including sort of irritant with some of their incoming rounds. And there were all sorts of reports and rumors that there was a lot heavier stuff coming in than just the regular 60 mortar and 82 millimeter mortar. About mid-morning, there was a tremendous explosion. And this, we found out later, was the TNT or the dynamite or some massive catch of explosives in our own ammo dump that had either burned to the point of impact. And it almost collapsed my bunker, although it had huge upright supporting the beams. It cracked a couple of them, and it knocked a couple of my people down. The adjutant got knocked down and injured his back. one or two of my other staff officers were knocked down, but nobody was really seriously hurt. And that was sort of the climatic point of the ammo dump, although we continued to have to step gingerly around while we were going out checking the perimeter.
This is all very good because there's quite a bit of footage of the ammo dump event.
Which, oh, really?
Which we can use your husband's voice to kind of... Well, this is going great. If you want to continue with the chronology, this is great.
Well,
and I can pick up, you know, I'll ask you specific questions later.
As we... initially, we were poised for a ground attack because we felt that the enemy... he felt that he had gotten our ammo dump, which obviously he had. He might have felt that we were very vulnerable. And at that point in time, it probably would have been one of the most opportune times for the enemy to attack. I feel that at that particular morning, that was our weakest point. From then on, things got better. The worst thing that happened was when the ammo dump blew up. So I had B Company, C Company, and D Company in the perimeter. A Company had been taken from me and fed to the hills. I still had the company commander of A Company, Colonel Captain Ray Snyder, a real sharp Naval Academy graduate who had a previous tour in Vietnam, was the company commander of A Company, but Ray was without troops. He had a few radio operators and a few stragglers that had come back from R&R that had not been able to make it up to the hill. So I immediately started making plans for my own counterattack group, although the recon company was in fact the regimental counterattack group. But I got with Ray Snyder, and having been at Khe Sanh for, by that time, 7 months, I felt that I knew every avenue of approach far better than the enemy, and I knew where the weak areas were. We had been doing some things other than just digging in and going on patrols, and we'd also been running med caps into the villages during that summer and fall, providing first aid to the villagers. We had been doing a few other little extra special things. I had brought a copy of Hell in a Very Small Place to Khe Sanh when I came in, and I made it required reading for all my officers because as soon as you mentioned the word Khe Sanh, people started comparing it to Dien Bien Phu. And there was some basis for comparison. There were other points that which you could not make any comparison at all between Dien Bien Phu and Khe Sanh. I think the most important difference is that Dien Bien Phu was way out on a limb, so to speak. The French had no real strong air support. They could not support Dien Bien Phu with their own artillery. They were just on their own. And the enemy had just decimated them down until they had nothing. At Khe Sanh, we could still receive direct artillery support from the 175 at Camp Carroll. We had Spooky 1-4 overhead. We had airships kicking out flares. We had airships, fixed-wing airships, with the most massive firepower known to man. Anti-personnel firepower, I might add, that we could have on just a few minutes' notice. So while there were many reasons to compare Dien Bien Phu to Khe Sanh, there were other reasons such as that it should not be compared. But when I mentioned we were working on other things, we had prepared fugaces and put them in place at several key avenues of approach to the base, and we had tested these and we knew they worked. We prepared these with the expert help of the engineers and the EOD people. We had 55-gallon drums filled with a mixture of gasoline. We had C3, and we had white phosphorus grenades. We rigged these up, sort of projected them into the avenues of approach. If there was a, in some cases out, there was a garbage dump that had been used for garbage probably for 2 or 3 years at Kaysan that I felt was probably the most opportune avenue of approach that the enemy could have. It also happened to be on the side of the camp which faced Route 9 as it went down toward Long Bay. So we had emplaced a few fugaces out there. We had a few fugaces in other spots. So that was just one of the surprises that we had for the NVA. For the layman, a fugace, it was set so it would be command detonated back by one of the people in my trenches, and it would just spray a tremendous amount of burning and flaming gasoline onto the misfortunate troops that happened to be in its path. And Ray Snyder and I worked up a deal where he was my private, personal little counterattack force.